A couple of summers later, I happened to be in Vancouver, and I got to know, by chance, a fellow in the film exchange, and this story came out during our talking, and he said, "Do you still have the card?" And I said, "No, I don't." Well, he said, "Don't worry." He said, "I can find who was visiting from down below." And he went through the list of those from Hollywood in those days who visited Canada that year, that summer. And he said, "Well, there's only one person who went to Banff who had anything like the authority to offer you a chance, and that was a fellow called Frank Capra."
Did he offer you a screen test?
Before he left the hotel, just before he left, as he handed me his card, he said, "I've been listening to you on the elevator." You know, calling up, going up, going down, or whatever, and calling out the floors, and speaking to people. And he said, "I like the tone of your voice." He said, "If you can find your way down to Hollywood," he said, "and go to this address," he says, "I'll give you a 10-year contract." And I said, "Ha ha," you know, just getting out of giving me a tip.
Yeah.
And I didn't do anything about it. Subsequently, I rather wish I had, but anyway, while I was in the amateur theatricals with Vancouver, I got very active both behind stage as well as on stage, and I managed to land a couple of leading parts, and was thoroughly enjoying myself and was gradually settling down to becoming a Vancouverite. And I got into the hotel business as a front desk clerk at the Grosvenor Hotel through meeting a person at in the Vancouver Little Theatre, because I was absolutely on my rock bottom. I'd worked for a time in Woodward selling rugs, and I knew nothing about rugs. I'd worked on the midnight shift of one of the dairies making ice cream, and that fell out naturally come winter because they didn't need the midnight shift. And I tried washing dishes in a dirty old restaurant. In fact, anything that I could find, and I was really on my uppers.
So the employment scene in Vancouver that time was bad?
Very bad. Even for those who were willing to do anything with it, irrespective of the fact that they had a degree. And
at this time, were you engaged?
No.
You weren't
just
formally
engaged? Just an understanding.
Understanding.
And I finally landed this job on just before Christmas in 1938. Grosvenor Hotel, and the manager, owner of the Grosvenor Hotel was a delightful fellow called E.C. Baines, an old-timer, and I mean old-timer.
How
he
old?
Remembers the boardwalks of Vancouver.
Yeah,
he remembered the fire in big Vancouver, and he owned a hotel up at the 100 Mile House.
Really?
And to get to 100 Mile House in those days, you had to be covered in dust before you got there. Old dirt highway.
I'll let you in on the secret. You still get covered in dust on the pavement up to 100 miles.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
But he was a delightful person to talk to. And for some reason or other, he took a liking to me, so I became a front desk clerk. I used to have to type out the menus for the dining room. It was a teetotal hotel. The old man wouldn't stand for any drinks at all. If any guest took drinks into his room, he found out about it, we were told in no uncertain terms that that person was never ever to get into the hotel again. And we did have a very nice dining room, but the only time we were really busy was when the Duke of Orleans came to town, because they liked the hotel because it was a teetotal hotel and it was right downtown, and they used to take over a whole floor.
Do you have any good Duke of Orleans stories for us?
No, I don't have any Duke of Orleans stories. So life was pretty wonderful, what with Rugger, with the rowing club and the amateur theatricals. And I was enjoying life. And then Katie got a job with the Vancouver General.
Mm-hmm.
And
was she a registered nurse?
No, she was a secretarial type.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to take dictation from doctors after they came out of the operating room, because they didn't have tape recorders. She had to take down, she had to learn how to spell all these medical terms and everything. So I used to spend many an evening checking out on her spelling of medical terms. And then the war came along. And I went to the Seaforth Armory to apply, to join, filled out the necessary form.
Okay, well, this had been in September of 39?
This was September 39.
Okay.
September the 3rd, to be exact.
Before we had even declared war.
It was coming. And
what was your initial reaction upon hearing that Germany had stormed into Poland, that England was supporting?
I figured that Canada was going, and I was going with Canada. The manager wasn't very happy with me because I didn't talk it over with him first. I went and applied, and however, I came back and said that I wasn't going because they wouldn't take me on my terms.
What were your terms?
I wanted to go as another rank, and they said no. I had to become an officer because I had a degree, I'd had previous military training, and I had to have to go through officer school.
So why did you not want to become an officer?
Oh, I did, but I didn't want to go unless I said to myself, what's the use of becoming an officer if I can't do the job of a private?
Mm-hmm.
Unless I know how to know what a private has to do, how the heck can I be a good officer? Maybe that's stupid thinking, but that's the way I thought in those days, and I'm afraid I still think so.
Mm-hmm.
If I can't do the job of the people under me, then what business am I doing over them?
So you're giving orders to people who really don't
know. Unless you know what they are faced with. Pretty hard to give an order with any understanding,
mm-hmm.
except saying, look, I am superior to you by rank, do as you're told,
mm-hmm.
don't argue. That doesn't carry any weight with me, I'm afraid.
So
I went to join up as a private. I was told by the assistant adjutant, a gentleman of the name of Donald McGilvery Clark,
mm-hmm.
who is now one of Vancouver's distinguished senior lawyers, that he couldn't take me on as a private. I'd have to go to officer school. And I said, no way. He said, well, scrub all your information on that sheet regarding a degree, the fact that you were with the London Scottish and had certificate B with the COTC. Scrub all that and I'll take you on. I said, nothing doing. Take me on as a private with that on there.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no. So I left.
Did you think of going to any other regiments?
No, because Highland is I wasn't going to the BC Dragoons or the Irish or anybody else. And I went back to the hotel, and at the beginning of December I heard they had all the officers they needed,
mm-hmm.
they had all the NCOs they needed, but they were still short one or two privates. So I went back, filled up my form all over again, and lo and behold, there was the assistant adjutant again, Donald McGilvery Clark. And again he said, can't take you on as a private. He said, you've been here before, haven't you? I said, well, yeah, several months ago. And he said, well, he said, I'm afraid I can't. And I said, look, who the hell is going to know that you've been taken on a man as a private who happens to have got a degree and has had some previous military training? He knows his left foot from his right foot. And he said, well, I guess nobody. And I said, well, then what's the problem? He said, no problem, just delete those things and I'll take you on. I said, nothing doing, they stay there. I said, I'm sure that they'll be giving people a chance to get commission from the ranks after we get overseas. I'll take my chance. So he said, all right. So I was taken on.
Okay, this was early December.
This was about the 12th of December.
You're cutting rather close because they moved out a couple days later.
They left on the 16th.
Okay, tell me about those few days then. Were you kitted out right away, or?
I was given a uniform. I was given all kinds of injections into my arm.
Perfect.
My arm swelled up to about twice its normal size. I couldn't stand to attention because I looked like a penguin. And
suitable officer material, I guess.
I was put into A Company. Company commander was a fellow called Doug Foran, who was a lawyer. And one other company commander wanted me in his company, and his name was Bert Hoffmeister, who subsequently became a major general. And I think the worst march I ever did in my life was from the Seaforth Armories down to the CPR station,
mm-hmm.
with a full kit on and rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I got down to the station, I had had it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I was reasonably physically fit.
Was it a long march?
No. It's only about, what, a mile and a half? But somehow or other, that pack pulling on my shoulders, which I wasn't used to, some of the fellows had been up in there in a couple of months. After all, it's a quick way off the old unemployment line.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been toting things around, and they'd been getting their feet in shape, and they'd broken their boots in. My boots were giving me hell because they were brand new and I hadn't broken them in. So it wasn't a very comfortable march. That was really, I really suffered. And we took off.
Well, tell me about your uniform, your weapon, and also about the organization itself.
Well, the battalion at the time had the headquarters, four rifle companies, and a headquarters company.
Mm-hmm. And you were an A company.
And I was an A company.
Mm-hmm. Who was the commander of the regiment at the time?
Popularly known as Swivel-Eyed Steve.
Swivel-Eyed?
Steve. His real name was Lieutenant Colonel Stevenson, a World War I soldier, first class, knew exactly what he was doing, a damn good disciplinarian, but he had eyes that when he was looking at you, you thought he was looking at people two ranks away from you.
It's dangerous, I should think.
Because you start to laugh, thinking he was looking at them, and he wasn't, he was looking directly at you. He was known as Swivel-Eyed Steve. He got the fellow so mad at him because he wasn't backward in handing out punishments. And that I would say that the morale in the unit was fantastic. They would have fought with anybody in the drop of a pin. But he was really good. But he was a stickler. And when you get a CO who's a nice Joe and not a stickler, the morale of the regiment drops. And somehow the fellows are not quite as proud. And they get sloppy about their shaving, sloppy about personal hygiene and everything. But he was terrific. And we had quite a trip across Canada. We were stuck on that train. It took 5 days, I think.
Non-stop, or did you?
No, we were allowed off the train at odd places. One of the worst places, a place called Trois-Rivières in Quebec, because it was winter there, and it was slippery, and we had these ruddy boots on, and we had the horrible, shapeless greatcoat, and we had these, I think we were still wearing ankle puttees in those days.
So you're talking about World War I uniforms?
World War I type uniforms. But they were just putties around the ankle.
Uh-huh.
They didn't go right up the knee. That's what I... Golly, my memory is really gummy. But I think that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And the roads were so slippery around Trois-Rivières and hilly that we were sliding and skidding and everything. We couldn't wait to get back on the train.
Mm-hmm.
That I remember particularly. And the other thing was arriving in Halifax, and the ship that we were assigned to was just out of this world. It was her maiden voyage with passengers. She belonged to the Royal Mail Steamship Line. She was designed for first-class traffic between England and Argentina.
Mm-hmm. Ironic, isn't it?
And at the moment, I can't remember her name. And, good. I was the Andes, that's right, the Royal Mail Steamship Andes. And she had a full complement of stewards and everybody.
Were they your beck and call?
Well, not quite, but we didn't have to go and scrub potatoes
mm-hmm.
in the kitchen. We were served, and we were privates. And we had our own, you know, six to a table or something. And we were served by the steward. He had nothing else to do. And I had a cabin that I shared with three other fellows. We had our own bath with a shower. And I tell you, it was fantastic. And that was our troop ship. And she was so fast that she could have left the convoy any time. But she didn't. She plowed along with the rest. Except that an operation had to be done by our MO. And to do it, in order to get a smooth run, the ship dropped back on the convoy and then speed it up. And during the speeding up, it got rid of the roll. And the MO went and did his operation, and everything was fine.
And the crossings all right, no submarine attack?
No submarine, as far as we know. We had the Canadian Navy escort us. We had the escort ships all around the perimeter of the convoy,
mm-hmm.
with the old war spite in the middle, and a naval and a French battleship at the back end of the convoy.
Mm-hmm. Not forgetting this was the entire Canadian 1st Division going off over at once.
That's right. And about halfway across, we came to for breakfast one morning, looked out, and there wasn't an escort ship in sight outside of the war spite and the French.
The Canadians had turned back.
Yeah. And then, later on, that same day, before dusk, from all points of the compass, the British Navy destroyers came in, took up position, and escorted us into Duroc. And it was really quite a fantastic thing. And of course, we arrived in Duroc, I think it was New Year's Eve. And we were shuttled by boat onto the shore. And as we arrived near the shore, we could hear these voices saying, "We don't want your ready Canadians to go back home." So that was our welcome.
Lovely.
Oh, yeah. And we took night train from Glasgow down to Aldershot,
mm-hmm.
actually to Farnborough. We got out of Farnborough, and then we had to march all of 3 miles to our new barracks, brand new barracks, never been occupied by anybody before us. Cove Barracks, outside Farnborough. And boy, they didn't have enough heat in there to keep a mouse warm when we moved in.
Mm-hmm.
And the old locals said, well, they were rationed on coal, they could only provide so much.
Had rationing started at this time already?
Oh, yes. Absolutely, particularly on coal.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in early February 1940, the battalion was called out on parade and it could barely muster one company of men.
Okay.
All the rest were down with flu.
Did you have the flu as well?
I got it. Only lasted about 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the boys were hit really badly.
Any deaths occurred by this?
No, no deaths, but some fellows were shunted back to Canada.
Was that bad?
It was awful, and we took over the heating of our own barracks then,
mm-hmm.
and we had to raise the ration in order to warm. But the way the English were warming us, boy, I'm telling you, you could put your hand on the radiator and you couldn't believe that there was any heat in there. And cold, it was miserable.
Quite a return, isn't it?
Oh. But I can remember marching into Cove Barracks through the village of Cove, hearing some local people saying, "Core, aren't these Canadians big fellas?" Most of us were emigrants from England coming back in. And when the regiment got its first leave, I think it was 90% of the regiment headed north of the border.
Mm-hmm.
Except some got waylaid at places like Birmingham and Manchester and didn't make it. And I went back to Bedford where my mother still was living. So we had a really quite a good return, but I've never forgotten that first winter. It was miserable.
Okay, so you're at Cove now, in the barracks. You really haven't had any training yet.
No. We knew our left foot from our right foot. We could do an about turn without knocking everybody down.
Mm-hmm.
And
so what happened?
And we'd marched and marched because we had to get leg fit. And the beginning of Cove Barracks, we learned about sections. We learned about mutual support, fire, and movement. It was beginning to filter in, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
But they were still talking of World War I type tactics.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I think, in the spring of 40 that we went down to Salisbury Plain, where I'd been as an English schoolboy.
Mm-hmm.
And to help me, they had us digging into that ruddy chalk,
mm-hmm.
and digging trenches and setting up watching posts. And we had to go and practice taking out scouting groups at night to find out what the enemy were doing, because
mm-hmm.
there were enemy in quotation marks in the form of the Grenadier Guards or something. And we had fun with them because I don't think many of the Grenadier Guards knew the difference between the sound of a cow munching and moving at night and a person. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't help talking. The Grenadier Guards, we found, couldn't help talking. However, we had a lot of fun, and we had a lot of marches, which racked up some of the fellows. Their legs just didn't take it. Mm-hmm. But I was lucky in A Company. We had a good morale and a good outfit. And compared with, I think, the Loyal Eddies and the Seaforth in our brigade were probably the two, the best. The Patricias, they were good, but I don't know, they seemed to be city boys more than anything else. Whereas the Loyal Eddies, and though we came from Vancouver, a lot of our fellows came from up the valley, from Kamloops and Vernon and all around there. They were ex-trappers, and they were outdoors people. And we had a higher percentage of that. And we seemed to do a little bit better than the Patricias to start with. Because the Patricias, I don't know why, but they just didn't seem, maybe had too many PF boys, permanent force boys.
That's a bit of a slur, isn't it?
Well, we didn't think much of the PF. We felt they were a bit stuck in their ways, that they weren't flexible enough, and that they paid so much attention to the rank system that the ones below were often frightened to make suggestions, where in the Loyal Eddies and the Seaforth, we were not backward, even though we were rear rank black file privates, and expressing our ideas of what we could do.
Yes, but didn't you find that that was also the case later in your, after the war, when you're in the permanent force, that it did revert back to that?
Oh yes, quite rapidly.
Because you were civilian soldiers, you really hadn't been disciplined
for
the military life.
That's right.
And I suppose that's why you're a bit
worried. I'm afraid I could never really take on to that rigid stuff.
Sure.
When I used to come out from Ottawa, from Army headquarters, to Griesbach Barracks in Edmonton, and used to visit the Patricias there on, for some reason or other, on duty, I knew several boys down in the ranks, and I used to leave the mess and go and join my pals down in their own place, and we'd get a little bit drunk, but we had a good time. But mm-hmm. I wasn't exactly popular with so-called brother officers.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find Jim Stone, however, is a different person altogether from that lot, even though he was a Patricia, but he was in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And he said any man who doesn't talk up is doing himself a disservice and is doing me a disservice as the commanding officer, because I don't know what you're thinking. So he was a different kettle of fish, but there were too many officers who felt that the lower ranks should mind their own business and just do as they're told,
mm-hmm.
which is unfortunate.
But that was the nature of the system, wasn't it? That,
well,
you went
tends
to the ranks.
It tends to be the nature
mm-hmm.
of the system, and I felt very sorry for reinforcements who came out to us in Italy, young fellows, university graduates, who came out with two shiny pips up and were given, put in charge of a platoon of about 30 men, of whom about 15% had been with the platoon ever since it landed in Sicily.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to call these young fellows and I'd say, now look, you've got a platoon sergeant who has already been the platoon sergeant for 3 months in battle,
mm-hmm.
and about 10 of your men are pretty battle-wise. So you're going to be the officer in charge. I said, you ask them for advice. I said, if anything goes wrong, you have the responsibility. But if everything is right, I said, you better thank them for it.
Mm-hmm.
So some of them I had to get rid of. They couldn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
They felt they'd been taught, you know, you give the orders and so forth. And they found it rough, but there was a big enough percentage that came through all right, were okay, but they were certainly given the old BS here back in Canada, the officer training school. It
well,
was
we'll
shocking.
Get back to 1940, I think we're getting a bit off track.
Way off track.
Way off track, let's talk about that. Okay, before Dunkirk, training and all, how far did you progress? Were you progressing well? Was morale good?
Morale was good.
Were you expecting to go to France?
We were hoping to go to France.
Mm-hmm.
We even got so far, some of us, were getting down to Somerset and sampling the Somerset cider. With the idea that would be that we, the rest of the unit would be following, and that we would be on our way to France through Brest.
Yeah.
I think 1st Brigade made it. We didn't.
Yeah. Was there not also rumored before the actual blitzkrieg in May for the unit to go up to Norway? So I was reading the Reading Up history and had something about that rumor.
Yes, there was talk of us going into Norway, but it didn't get much beyond talk, except some of the officers went somewhere or other. I was in the ranks and I didn't know too much of what was going on, except we got the odd rumor. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, Spitsbergen came along, but the Loyal Eddies went there, not us, and that made us kind of mad.
But
somebody decided, no, except that we got mad that we hadn't been selected to go. You know, who are these Loyal Eddie boys? They're a bunch of trappers. They give them anything different than a snare or something like that, and they get all tied up and don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Howard Jim Stone went with them as a company sergeant major, and they had their problems on that trip. We settled down, and I think it was in when we were up in the Midlands. We'd been sent up into the Midlands, and I can't help telling this little story. We had a young officer of the name of, our present lieutenant governor. Bell Irving.
Yeah.
Roger Bell Irving, lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
And we were having this move from Cove Barracks up into Nottinghamshire, I think it was. Top secret. And lo and behold, when we arrived at our destination, there was Mrs. Bell Irving, saying, "Welcome, fellow, welcome." So Budge was called up on the mat before Swivel-Eyed Steve,
mm-hmm,
as to how come his wife knew enough of where we were going to be there waiting for us when we arrived.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, Budge was moved up to meet a fellow called Brigadier G.R. Perks,
mm-hmm,
who tore a strip off him.
Mm-hmm.
And Budge became a better man altogether after that.
Mm-hmm.
He was a bit of a stinker before that, but he became a much better person after that. But that's one little story. And it was while we were in Nottinghamshire that we had our first air raid alarm, and we'd been told we were in Bell tents, believe it or not, Bell tents, wide open field. No, we were under trees that were supposed to camouflage, but there were enough tracks leading into Bell tents and into this Bell tent and into the whatever we were having our meals and so forth. Anybody from there could have seen there were troops there. Anyway, we were learning, and this night air raid alarm went off, and we'd been told that we'd get the hell out of the tents and into our slit trenches, which we dug conveniently to the Bell tent.
Mm-hmm.
So I, being a very, very deep sleeper, was the last to wake up. And of course tried to make it first out of the tent, and I hit the pole with my shoulder and something snapped and the tent came down, and the rest of us were struggling to get out, and we landed on top of each other eventually in this ruddy slit trench, which we realized we hadn't dug nearly wide enough or long enough because we were too lazy. And after all, if you're not under fire, why sweat? And we learned to dig it a little deeper the next day and a little wider. And that was our first experience.
Mm-hmm.
And
were you scared at all when you heard these sirens?
No, not scared.
Yeah.
Kind of excited.
Yeah.
And then we were moved from there down into Kent,
mm-hmm,
near a place called Edenbridge. And we were put into the open field there. We slept under the hedgerows. No Bell tents anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So rain or shine, you lived under a Bell tent. By this time I was a corporal.
Lance corporal or full?
No, I was full corporal by now. This was in the summer of 40. And
so Dunkirk was over.
Yeah, and we'd been moved down to Kent,
mm-hmm,
because we were, the Canadian Division was the only armed unit still in existence in Great Britain.
Okay. What were your arms when you...
Well, we had rifles. We didn't have bows and arrows. We could have, but we didn't.
Uh-huh.
We had rifles, and we had Lewis guns, I think.
No Bren yet.
No Bren yet.
Mm-hmm.
And
Vickers 303s?
No, we didn't have any machine guns.
No machine guns at all?
Not the C-4s.
Just a light...
It was just an infantry battalion.
What about boys' anti-tank rifles?
They had just come out, I think. Ruddy, heavy things to carry.
Yeah.
Oh, they were ghastly.
That's
just ghastly. The fellow who designed that didn't carry it. It was just pitiful.
Yeah.
However, we had them, but we had one big fellow in my platoon who just handled that like a match.
Mm-hmm.
No problem at all, but when any of us ordinary fellows tried to take it, we'd last about an hour with it. That would be about it. So we were down in the fields in Eden, near Edenbridge.
Mm-hmm.
And the summer, fortunately, was reasonably good. And during our... We just sat and waited. We used to have to keep our... kept clean and so forth, but really and truly we didn't do very much except sit and wait for something to happen.
Did you feel that something would happen? Or?
Well, we were getting air raids at night.
Attacking you specifically or
no.
Flying over you?
Flying over.
Mm-hmm.
We were the safest spot anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you see dog fights going on overhead?
Very little.
Mm-hmm.
Very little. Even though Biggin Hill was just north of Edenbridge. And that's where the British fighters were taking off from. But they were meeting most of the Germans right down at that time. We were meeting them right on the coastline. And we got a cricket match going with the local Edenbridge team. And I was asked if I'd ever played cricket, and I said, yes, I had. So I turned out and played cricket. And while playing the game, one of our officers, who was also playing, came up to me and said, how would you like to be intelligence sergeant? That position is now vacant. I said, sure, you bet. And he said, you think you can handle it? I said, sure. So
you know,
I had to...
What the job entailed?
Not a
point?
Clue. So I went before the commanding officer,
mm-hmm.
and he asked me if I could ride a motorbike. And I said, yes, sir. I'd never been on one in my life.
Mm-hmm.
He then asked me if I'd ever taken drafting. And I said, yes, sir. Well, I had. I wasn't telling a lie there. I had taken drafting while I was in school.
Mm-hmm.
Not for very long, but I'd taken it. So he said, fine. We're going on a little exercise tonight. A couple of companies will be involved. And he said, I'm going to go along and find out how they operate. He said, I'll be in my staff car. We're going cross country. And he said, I want you to follow me. On a motorbike, which I'd never been on before in my life,
mm-hmm.
of any kind, to go cross country at night, no lights. So I went down to the motor transport section, found out the bike that I was to be mine, and it was a Norton, thank goodness,
mm-hmm.
and I had to find out how to start the damn thing, and how to operate the throttle, and the brakes,
mm-hmm.
and I was wished a lot of luck, off I went, and I think I lugged that motorbike more than I rode it cross country, but I survived. And I became the intelligence sergeant for the C-4.
Okay, now what did the intelligence sergeant do?
Well, the intelligence sergeant had to do all the odd jobs that the CO cared to hand him.
Mm-hmm. Did you work under the assigned CO? Or
I reported directly to the commanding officer because there was no intelligence officer.
There was no lieutenant in charge or a captain?
There should be, but there wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
At least if there was. He was doing other things. So I reported directly to the commanding officer, and my job really and truly was to, anytime he was told to report to an O group, I was the one who led him there, because he had difficulty reading maps.
Really?
After all, in World War I, he didn't have to.
No, there was a trench, didn't have to worry about it.
And I guess he thought that because I was English, that I knew the Kent countryside. Which I didn't, because I'd never been to Kent before. But that's one thing I had to do, and another job I had to do was when the Germans really started their night raids in the fall of 40, I had to keep track of every bomb that fell in a certain district around the battalion area. Mm-hmm. Give me all the map locations of it, the time, and damage done, if any, and so on and so forth. And that kept me hopping around. We moved out of the hedgerows around Edenbridge in the fall into Limps Field. And there we were billeted in houses. And behind north of Limps Field, there is an escarpment. And one night I noticed a light flashing from a tree on the top of the escarpment, and it was coincident with the German bombers coming into London. Mm-hmm. And I got in touch with the intelligence officer at brigade headquarters, and he said, "I'll be back to you." He apparently got in contact with the division, and finally he got back to me and said, "Try and grab the guy that's doing that, because the 5th Columnists has set up a system of lights all the way from the coast right up into London, and they were flashing these lights which would alert the Germans who were not, they were navigating on beam rather than on straight navigation, and this would give them additional confidence that they were on the right beam to get into whatever part of London they were going to." So I and my intelligence section.
How many men did you have working?
I had 10 men. We took off, I and my motorbike, and they in a, I've got a small 1500 weight.
Lorry?
Yeah, well, a 1500 weight, I wouldn't call it a lorry. Just like a pickup truck. Mm-hmm. And we went up onto the escarpment before last light. We knew the general area from having taken compass bearings. And we settled down to wait until we heard the bombers come over, and you could say at that time of the year, at that particular time, you could set your watch by the German bombers. 7 o'clock every night, right on tap, they started coming over. And so we saw a light in our area flash on, and it was up fairly high. So we moved in around it, and we got to the base of the tree, which was supporting the light on the top, and there was nobody there, and nobody had passed any of us as we closed in on it. And we found this cord from the light coming down the tree, and we traced it for just over half a mile to where the man had been operating it.
He'd gone,
and he never operated it again, not in that area.
Were there any leads at all?
I have no idea. We read our report, and that was it.
Mm-hmm. Well, at this point, I think we should stop.
I think so, too. I think so.
We've been at it quite some time.
Would you feel like a drink? 'Cause I...